Go to everydaynovelist.com/support to join the madness.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life.
Welcome to The Questions,
episode 821.
Today, Kitty asks...
So, on this podcast several times, you have talked about the process of getting ideas for your stories, and the question's been asked at different times in different ways in different aspects of the question. And you've often talked about how, for you, the writing process and the ideas process is taking two or more disparate, conflicting ideas or unrelated ideas and throwing them together and seeing what happens. So that got me wondering, for you, is writing basically a way to think out loud on paper? And do you think that's the case generally?
Well, I don't think it's just that, but yeah, it's a thinking mode called dialectic, where one works thoughts out by arguing or by exploring conflicts. In philosophical terms, you know, it's looking for nuance when two apparently true ideas that are apparently in conflict are both on the table and you have to reconcile them.
I think of rabbinic debates when you mention this.
Rabbinic debates are a perfect form of dialectic. The way that Ernst Hegel, the philosopher, posited it was that he actually had a theory of history, that history moves from thesis to antithesis to synthesis. And while he's not exactly right, in my opinion, about the way history works, in terms of the way thought works and exploring ideas work, that's exactly correct.
Although, from his perspective, history is a history of thoughts.
And it's an unfolding of ideas in conflict with each other. But I think that that's just as I think that Marx's materialist view of history is has got an interesting kernel of truth in it, but is reductionistic to the point of, well, obviously being dangerous, but also reductionistic to the point of being untrue. I think that Hegel's view of history as the chronicle of competing ideas, while containing a real kernel of truth, is also reductionistic to the point of being false and or dangerous. But in terms of a method of thinking, dialectic is one of the most reliable ways to reason, because it forces you to take into account things which you might not be inclined to give credence to. The scientific method in this way can be seen as a form of dialectic where the antithesis is not necessarily another idea, but is instead the empirical data that you then test your hypothesis with in an attempt to falsify it, so that the discipline of reality becomes the antithesis in the dialectic, and the synthesis is the theory which you then formulate as the result of repeated and iterated observation, hypothesis, and experimentation that synthesizes the data that you've gathered. In fiction, the dialectic plays out necessarily, at least if you're going to have a good story, because fiction requires conflict to be workable. That conflict can be between characters who have opposing interests. It could be between characters who have opposing points of view, which aren't necessarily the same thing, though interests would then follow from those points of view, or between a character and a system that he or she is going up against, or a character and the world he or she finds themselves in. But any kind of writing that isn't propagandistic is dialectical. The quality of the dialectic varies depending on the nature of the writing and the skill of the writer and the skill in thinking that the writer has, which isn't the same thing. You can have excellent writers who are very sloppy thinkers, and you can have very poor writers who are excellent thinkers. But one of the reasons that composition, essay composition, is one of the seven liberal arts passed down from antiquity is that it is the way that children are taught to reason. That's why, up until recently, the essay was the de rigueur basis of all education, the essay and then mathematics. As standardized testing and the need for standardized testing, whether it was real or not, it was certainly a felt need for standardized testing, came about during the industrial era and especially in the Cold War. It came in because education was in the national interest. It was a national security issue on both sides of the Iron Curtain. You needed people who could do their math and who could regurgitate the party line and who could demonstrate that they had read the canonical texts of their civilization or at least faked it well enough to pass a test. There's an interesting critique that I recently heard Brett Weinstein give of the way that libertarians think about culture and economics. And his argument was essentially that libertarian thinking taken too far subjects portions of human nature and life to market forces that shouldn't be subjected to market forces, that can't be subjected to market forces without corrupting them beyond all recognition. And though I would love to sit down with him and have a fight over some of the nuances, there's a kernel of truth in what he's saying, and you can really see it in the way that standardized testing took over education, replacing the somewhat sloppier process of essay and grading and things like that. The idea that you can measure with metrics someone's ability to think and know is ludicrous, and the educational research, the quantitative educational research, doesn't bear this out.
And of course, the standardized testing came about partly as a way to increase objectivity rather than subjectivity, because there was valid concern that people were being graded unfairly because of who they were or where they came from versus how they were thinking.
Right. Well, and that was certainly one of the concerns that drove the public to accept standardized testing. But I think it was a Mott and Bailey situation. The interests of the educational establishment were very clearly on the side of producing workers who could function in an industrial environment and of producing citizens and scientists who could be a valuable asset in geopolitical struggles. And the idea was that standardized testing would give you a very good, quick way to sort people according to abilities so you could slot them into their slots. Now, if it worked, the conversation to be had around that would be whether this kind of segregation produces a healthy society. But the fact that it doesn't work, which can be seen in the high proportion of people who are atypical achievers who were failures in school, or, for example, in the fact that people who fall out of the neurotypical range because they're on the spectrum or because of other cultural reasons or whatnot simply don't test well, gives the lie to whether this is useful at all. And my contention at the moment is that the move towards standardized testing has actually, on a broad scale, enervated the idea of the common citizen to think clearly, because they never have to work out their thoughts in long form unless they have that as a hobby. They're never forced to do that when it's early and uncomfortable and kind of embarrassing. So they do not get the early practice in careful thought that is important for members of a free society who have the vote, as opposed to members of a feudal society or a totalitarian society or a technocratic society, where the interest is entirely on establishing order and slotting people into their place. So, yeah, writing fiction is a form of practice of dialectic. And that's why that technique of bringing disparate ideas together to set each other off works to generate stories. And it's wonderfully mirrored in the natural world. All sexual reproduction in the whole plant and animal kingdom is made up of the mixing of dissimilar elements that together form a synthesis of a new life form. And then on a lower level of the interaction of atoms, hydrogen and oxygen, there's no reason a priori you might predict that they would come together to form water and have those properties. But they do. Two flammable gases come together to make one of the least flammable substances in the known universe.
Anti-flammable.
Yeah. So it's mirrored at every level of reality, and then up from the biological, the social, and up from the sexual, you get the biological species competing with each other for food and finding ways of cooperation so that the ecosystem works for all involved, and it goes up to the social level.
So one of the things that you're doing is you're advocating, advising, and utilizing deliberate form of a process that occurs naturally.
Yes.
This is typical of you.
It is it's the most productive force in the universe, literally. And there's no reason it shouldn't be productive creatively. And if you read the writings of people who have written about the experience of creativity, invariably in one form or another, you'll see this. I had this notion and I didn't know what to do with it until I had this experience, or I read this book, or I had this idea.
Mm-hmm.
Some people understand explicitly that they're using the ideas to set each other off. Other people just intuit that they're looking for some kind of tension to explore to make their stories work, or their music,
mm-hmm.
or whatnot. But whether it's explicit or implicit, the process is always the same. And so if you're finding yourself creatively lost, you can actually fall back on doing that intentionally, and you're plugging right into the stuff that makes the universe go round.
That is fascinating. Thank you.
Yeah, my weird brain.
Yeah. Very weird, but that's what I love about it.
Well, hey, and that's a good thing, because I got to live with you. So, anyway, that's it for us freewheeling here. We'll be back tomorrow with the first of the Gail Carriger episodes, and she'll be with us, I believe, for 12 days, where she and I together answer your questions, and then we'll be back after that with more of your questions and weird thoughts that I happen to have.
12 days, huh? How much tea did you need to keep her hostage that long?
Ungodly amounts. Which is only fair when you're dealing with two people like us, so. But until then, I'll see you all tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian, and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer, and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.
Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.